By downloading or listening to this podcast, you are agreeing to Moody's legal terms and conditions found at moodys.com/disclaimer, including that the information provided is not investment or financial advice, and that Moody's will not be liable for losses arising from your use of the information.
I'm Danielle Reed, and this is Moody's Talks, Focus on Finance. In today's episode, my co-host Miles Nelligan talks to Manoj Jatani and Laura Baser of the insurance team and Rory Callagy of the asset management team about why the outlooks for global and U.S. life insurers, as well as global asset managers, are moving from negative back to stable. Miles, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Danielle. Always happy to be here.
Miles, about a year ago, the world was looking very different, and Moody's outlook on life insurers in some major insurance markets, such as Japan and the U.S., and globally, and also global asset management, shifted to negative. So now we've seen a reversal. What's behind it?
There are a few things going on, Danielle. Economic recovery in the wake of the coronavirus vaccinations is a major factor. The pandemic is receding in many countries. Restrictions on businesses and on travel are starting to be lifted, and market volatility is lower. All of that is positive for life insurers and also for asset managers. With the pandemic receding, there are fewer excess deaths, so what insurers call mortality is heading towards more usual ranges. That helps life insurance companies.
In other words, the very same factors that caused Moody's to shift outlooks to negative a year ago are reversing.
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
Thanks, Miles. I'll look forward to hearing more details when you talk to Manoj, Laura, and Rory later. But first, from New York, insurance team analyst James Eck is joining to talk about the latest developments in Puerto Rico's debt settlements.
Thanks for having me, Danielle.
James, you and I spoke a couple of years ago about the settlements of Puerto Rico's debts. To give our listeners a little context, Puerto Rico's bankruptcy, which dates back to 2016, involves more than $70 billion in debt, making it the largest U.S. municipal bankruptcy. Some of that debt is guaranteed by financial guarantors, Moody's rates, and they, along with other parties trying to maximize recoveries in the bankruptcy, have been waiting for final settlements to come through. So, James, what's changed from the last time we spoke?
Right. So actually, there's been a fair amount of change after a bit of a stall due to the coronavirus pandemic. But over the last few months, we've seen two plan support agreements agreed to between Puerto Rico's oversight board and creditors. The first covered the Commonwealth's general obligation bonds, as well as the Commonwealth guaranteed public buildings authority bonds. The second agreement was between the oversight board and some of the financial guarantors that covered revenue bonds issued by Puerto Rico Highways and Transportation Authority and the Puerto Rico Convention Center District Authority. So for the financial guarantors, if we include the 2019 restructuring support agreement with PREPA, which is Puerto Rico's electric power utility, it means that roughly 90% or more of their exposure to Puerto Rico is now subject to consensual settlement agreements. And this clearly reduces the amount of uncertainty for ultimate losses for the guarantors, which we consider to be credit positive.
Okay, thanks for the update. And in your report, you noted that the recoveries are now looking even more favorable for the guarantors than was the case the last time we talked.
That's correct, Danielle. Based on the plan support agreement for the general obligation bonds, the base recovery is about 79 cents on the dollar, which consists of cash, new bonds, and various fees. But there's also a contingent value instrument that's part of the settlement package. And this is based on future sales tax receipts on the island over the next 22 years. So to the extent Puerto Rico's economy recovers and does better than was projected in the certified fiscal plans of the Commonwealth, this contingent value instrument will receive future cash flows and increase the economic recovery for creditors, including the financial guarantors. We estimate the present value of the contingent value instrument to be around 5% of par, which would lead to an overall recovery of around 84 cents on the dollar on the vintage pre-2011 general obligation bonds. And this is much better than the 65 cent recovery we were projecting for the GO bonds a couple of years ago. You can also see the improved recovery expectations in the market prices for unwrapped Puerto Rico bonds, which are now trading at their highest levels since the Commonwealth defaulted back in 2016.
That is a big improvement. Now, of course, not every financial guarantor has the same exposure to this debt, and some are more exposed than others, right?
That's right. You know, some have more exposure relative to their capital, but there's also differences in which bonds the guarantors have exposure to. So we think that recoveries on the so-called clawback bonds, such as Highways and Transportation and Convention Center District Authority, will have much higher loss severities relative to the general obligation bonds, and therefore guarantors that have outsized exposures to those issuers will have to pay higher claims. So ultimately, Puerto Rico losses are a function of which particular exposures each guarantor has.
Got it. One last point. These settlements still have to be approved, right? What's the risk to the guarantors if they're not approved?
That's correct. The settlements do need to be approved in the Title III court, which will take some time. In the event that these settlements cannot be approved and ratified by the court, then there could be some risk of a judicial determination of how to adjust the debt, which could lead to higher losses. But that's not our expectation at this point. So the key issue from a credit perspective is that we view both Assured Guarantee and National Public Finance Guarantee to be effectively fully reserved or nearly fully reserved against their Puerto Rico exposures at this point. So what that means is that any further loss charges should be relatively minor compared to earnings and capital at these companies. Now we just need to see the settlements confirmed in the Title III court, which is expected to occur sometime in 2022.
So overall, a positive story for the guarantors. James, thank you very much for your time and insights. Next up, my co-host Miles Nelligan will speak to Manoj Jatani and Laura Baser of the insurance team and Rory Callaghy of the asset management team about why negative outlooks are moving back to stable for global and U.S. insurance and global asset management. Miles, over to you.
Thanks very much, Danielle. So last year, Moody's outlooks for global life insurance, U.S. life insurance, and global asset management all shifted to negative. But this year, they're moving back to stable. We'll be looking at how the operating environment for insurers has changed later this month at our Insurance Week conference, which runs from June 21 to June 25. But for now, Manoj, since we have you with us, perhaps you could tell our listeners why the global life insurance outlook is moving back to stable.
Sure, Miles. We've changed the outlook for both US life insurers and Japanese life insurers to stable in the last few weeks. These are two large insurance markets that account for more than a third of all premiums worldwide. With this change, most life insurance outlooks around the world are now stable. And in some regions where we have a negative outlook, such as the United Kingdom, we have seen signs of operating environment stability, improving profitability, and strong solvency ratios through the first half of the year. Globally, economic activity is also picking up speed. Following a 3.2% decline in GDP last year, Moody's now expects that the G20 economies will grow by 6.1%, driven by solid demand.
Okay, Manoj, you mentioned the operating environment. Laura, by that, I assume we mean the economic recovery we've seen, which is contributing to improved conditions for life insurers in the US and elsewhere.
Yes, that's right, Miles. The rapid pace of vaccinations in the US and the loosening of pandemic restrictions, along with monetary and fiscal stimulus, are what are driving our forecast of strong 6.5% GDP growth this year. And this is good for life insurers because it puts more income in the hands of consumers to buy life insurance products, which are discretionary. It also allows agents to get out and sell person to person. Basically, some products are too complex to sell online. We're also seeing a return of inflation. We're projecting a rise of 100 basis points from current levels. And this is actually favorable to life insurers because new money rates will rise and this will increase net investment income. It'll also widen spread income on some insurance products without precipitating elevated surrenders.
Thanks, Laura, for that really clear summary. Rory, what about the asset managers? What's the biggest effect on that sector of a stronger economic outlook?
Thanks, Miles. So the reopening of the economy globally has supported the rally in financial markets that we've seen for several quarters now. And this is favorable for asset managers because it lifts their assets under management, which is the primary driver of revenues and earnings. But two of the other bigger factors in driving our improved outlook for this sector is that we've seen improved active equity performance, which is an area of that's been quite a challenge for the industry over the last 10 years or so. So that, in addition to the fact that we're seeing improved net flows at asset managers, so improved organic asset growth, we think the combination of those two with a stronger market has been supportive of our improving view of the sector.
Thanks, Rory. Manoj, back to you. You mentioned that Japan and the US are the two big markets that have shifted to stable from negative, and that this is driving the global change in outlook. Apart from economic recovery, are there any other factors that are driving the change in outlook for Japan?
So, Miles, aside from the economic recovery, we're observing a handful of developments in the Japanese life insurance market, namely improved capitalization, lower asset risk, and a strong distribution franchise. Despite there being still some lingering threat from the pandemic, these variables collectively support a stable outlook for the sector over the next 12 to 18 months. Just to add some context to those themes, we anticipate capital generation to remain strong, fueled by financial market recovery, favorable regulation, and enhancements we've seen on both the product and distribution side. The pandemic has increased consumer awareness of medical hazard, as well as demand for medical protection products, which are generally more profitable. And finally, the Japanese regulator, that is the Japanese Financial Services Agency, will implement a new economic value-based capital regulation in the next few years. Before the implementation, we expect Japanese insurers to take steps to increase economic capital, which will reduce investment risk, including equity and interest rate risk.
Okay. Laura, one US-specific factor that you mentioned in your report is that companies may now be able to find buyers for their interest rate-sensitive businesses. These businesses, of course, have been a drag on their results for some time.
Yes, that's right. Despite a recent uptick in interest rates and inflation, interest rates have really been declining for literally decades, and relatively speaking, they're still at historic lows. And this has driven a business transformation in the life insurance industry, with companies exiting interest-sensitive and capital-intensive and guaranteed businesses in exchange for more fee-driven and capital-light ones. And plentiful M&A capital, including from private equity firms, has helped and should continue to help drive this business shift into the future.
Rory, back to you. Your report talks about how a certain set of asset managers has been able to navigate lower rates successfully. We're talking here about managers of alternative assets, that is to say, not traditional stocks and bonds, but things like private loans.
Yeah, alternative asset managers have been a bright spot within the industry for several years, and they continue to shine during the pandemic. And one of the reasons why they've been performing so well is, with interest rates being so historically low, institutional investors, who are the main clients of alternative asset managers, can't generate the returns that they need in the fixed income asset classes. So they're looking to private markets as a way to generate those needed returns. And alternative asset managers are a big provider of private market capabilities. So the combination of the two has allowed them to generate a lot of flows and convert those flows into higher fee-related earnings. And through the stronger markets that we've seen over the last several quarters, they're starting to see higher performance fees. So the combination of higher fee-related earnings and performance fees has allowed them to continue to outperform relative to other companies within the sector.
I actually have one last question for the insurance team. It seems the pandemic accelerated a shift toward digitization of operations that had been already happening. And Laura, I think you mentioned in your report that this has been another positive for U.S. insurers.
That's right, Danielle. Insurers were already well on the path to full digitization of their insurance processes before the pandemic hit, but the pandemic really accelerated it. So operations, sales, marketing, underwriting, things like that, all were forced online from one week to the next during the pandemic. We saw agents selling by video conference, underwriting entirely went online. Customers were forced to use e-signature and e-payment if they really wanted to get that policy. And we're thinking that a lot of this change will be permanent because basically it shortens the time it takes for a consumer to get an insurance policy. And that keeps life insurers relevant with their customers who've become increasingly digitally sophisticated.
Got it. Laura Manoj, Rory, Miles, and James, thank you all very much for joining the show. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. If you'd like to read any of the reports mentioned in this episode, you can find them by clicking on the link for the episode at about.moodys.io/podcasts. And to register, if you'd like to join us for Insurance Week, June 21 to 25, you can do that at our events page, events.moodys.io. And please join us again on Wednesday, June 30th for the next episode of Focus on Finance.